Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today is my good friend, Sam Bendett of the Center for Naval Analyses. He is also affiliated with the Center for a New American Security, as well as the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Sam, thanks so very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure having you on, with or without Eugene or any other guest.
Great to be back, Vago.
Indeed, a pleasure. Before we get started, our coverage of strategy and conversations with leading national security thinkers is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, the late, great Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. The strategy series is not affiliated with the Andrew W. Marshall Foundation. Sam, you've been giving us weekly updates now for the last couple of years on the progress of the war. You know, Russia has been increasing strikes across Ukraine, including increasingly using hypersonic missiles, maneuvering glide bodies to try to overwhelm and circumvent Ukrainian air and missile defenses. They're getting to their targets, unfortunately, whether they're slower flying Shahed-type aircraft, the Lancet, the Russian jet-powered variant of that, and of course, hypersonic means. About 1 million Ukrainians who are plunged into darkness, and many of the targets are unfortunately civilian targets the Russians are focusing on. It's getting harder and harder for Ukraine to defend, in part because it's running short on air defense weapons, and indeed the entire West is, which has been part of Russia's strategy, right? I'm willing to expend a lot in order to defeat Ukraine, and it's playing a long game. How is Russia changing how it attacks Ukraine as it prepares for its own offensive? And we'll get to that and some of Defense Minister Shoigu's comments in a moment across what is a very, very long front line.
Well, Russia has been intensifying its strikes against Ukraine just since the beginning of this year. There have been multiple missile and drone attacks, including by long-range Garand drones as well. You have to give credit to the Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian air defense for being able to withstand such barrages over the past 2 years and for shooting down most of these drones. So while Russia is intensifying its attacks, it's clear that Ukrainian defenses are holding and that Ukrainian defenses are actually quite capable. In fact, Russians are actually copying some of the Ukrainian tactics. Just last week, Russian Ministry of Defense has announced the creation of mobile air defense units, which are likely modeled on the Ukrainian units, with light trucks armed with machine guns, with heavier trucks armed with automatic cannon. So they're finally copying what has worked for Ukraine all this time. And this is why Ukrainian defense industry is still capable. And that's why Ukrainian economy is actually quite capable, notwithstanding all of these attacks. It is likely that Russian missile and drone strikes are going to intensify, which is why, of course, Ukraine is now targeting Russian drone manufacturing facilities. And I'm referring to yesterday's long-range Ukrainian strike deep into the Russian heartland, where they attacked an Alabuga manufacturing plant that actually manufactures these Garand/Shahed long-range drones, which create a lot of panic in Russia and actually raise a lot of question about Russian ability to defend against such Ukrainian reprisals.
And how are the Ukrainians able to do this? Because Russia, you know, has been defined by some as a clown show, in part because sometimes its tactics are not very sophisticated. Sometimes, you know, it presents itself as more fearsome. It generally leans on brutality rather than military excellence to achieve its successes. I mean, you would imagine 2 years after this, after even the Kremlin itself was attacked, that the Russians would be getting better at this, right? You mentioned the Ukrainian gun trucks. There are 2,000 of them around the country that are part of a rapid alert battery that they respond almost immediately to, especially low-flying cruise missiles and slower flying unmanned vehicles like the Shahed. How are the Russians still this open to Ukrainian attacks that are getting bolder and bolder, right? I mean, their fuel facilities have been incapacitated by their attacks.
Right. And it's likely that Russian air defenses are applied piecemeal, and the quality of air defenses in different areas around different locations varies from location to location. We actually see that on full display with the Russian Black Sea Fleet's inability to fully defend its vessels, right? The Russian Black Sea Fleet in Sevastopol is probably much better defended against Ukrainian USV attacks than some of that fleet that was stationed in Novorossiysk, which was wide open to Ukrainian USV strikes a few months back, after all of the warnings, after all of the threats are actually on full display. So in the military and across Russian defense agencies, this type of application, security application or lessons learned application, is probably uneven and is applied piecemeal. So it is likely that the Kremlin, for example, is probably very well protected today. It is likely that many locations in and around Moscow are very well protected, which is why Ukrainians are no longer launching their strikes against Russia's capital city. But it is very difficult to protect every single important site in Russia's European territory. And I'm referencing a lot of oil refineries, a lot of infrastructure nodes, military warehouses, military manufacturing facilities. And that's why Ukraine still is capable at getting around Russian air defense pockets and bubbles and striking Russians exactly where it hurt. Yesterday's strike deep into the Kazan region is quite surprising. It's quite a long distance from the Ukrainian border.
How long is it for those people who are not familiar with the distance?
It's roughly 1,200 kilometers or 800 miles.
Wow.
So one would think that a light aircraft, Cessna-like aircraft, that is flying in that space would probably be sighted and identified in one form or another. But we only see that sort of identification when it's actually too late and when it's about to slam into one of the Alabuga buildings. Ukrainians probably took advantage of Russians' own ineptitude, of the uneven application of air defenses and electronic warfare defenses. And of course, we have to recognize that Russia is a big country with a big population and a lot of industrial activity. So there's probably a lot of light aircraft in Russia's airspace to begin with. And so the drone that attacked Alabuga was actually refitted light Cessna-like aircraft, which probably looked like any other aircraft in the Russian airspace. So there's a lot that Ukrainians can still do, but this places most of Russia's European territory, most of Russia west of Urals, where the bulk of the population, the bulk of the industry, and the bulk of the military infrastructure is located, well within Ukrainian kamikaze strikes.
And did the Alabuga raid, was it successful? I mean, did it debilitate? Because there's one thing to mount attacks, which are great and they feel good, but the question is whether or not they're actually slowing Russia's war or oil machinery. Are these strikes having an impact?
Well, the strikes on oil facilities certainly had an impact. The United States even put Ukraine on notice that such strikes should probably stop because they're actually impacting the global oil and energy markets. The fact that Ukrainians hit Alabuga was just a matter of time because this is where the Gerein drones are located. And as I just mentioned, since the beginning of this year, there's been an intensifying amount of strikes by Gerein drones in several thousand, actually, against Ukraine. So hitting Alabuga in one form or another was just a matter of time. Russians are claiming that the strike hit the dormitory where young people who manufacture these drones are located. Obviously, other damage assessments probably point to slightly different targets. But anything that could be done from the Ukrainian standpoint, anything that could be done to slow down the manufacture process at Alabuga is a net plus.
Indeed, and also apply, you're right, add the cost of defenses and everything to that equation, right? It's a cost imposition strategy. Let's shift to the front line, actually. Right, I mean, a lot of reporting on how Ukraine is under stress. Volodymyr Zelensky has said the question is how to withdraw from some of these places, right? I mean, the Ukrainians fought hard. They had a counteroffensive. It was not that successful, I think, in part because we didn't supply them what we needed when they needed it to do it on their timetable. And they still went ahead and they did it. They made incremental gains and lost a lot of people to protect certain areas, Avdiivka being one of them, where the Russians threw just an enormous amount of resources and people at it. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu is claiming that Ukraine is losing territory. Is Ukraine losing territory? Is it retreating tactically? And what are the distances that we're talking about, right? Russia took a big chunk of Ukraine. Ukraine took back a large chunk of the territory it had originally lost, but is committed to reclaiming all lost Ukrainian territory, which is about 20% of the country. Walk us through where the front line stands now as the Russians do prepare their offensive. And the Ukrainians, after too long of a wait, are beginning to dig in finally to, you know, make their lives a little bit easier when it comes to defending.
So from the tactical standpoint, any exchanges in territory are rather incremental. So we're obviously not seeing any massive losses or gains that we have witnessed in 2022. One of the difficulties in any type of large-scale maneuver or any large-scale logistics or supply runs to and from the front, as we have discussed over and over, is the presence of a lot of ISR assets, including UAVs, which now swarm the Ukrainian skies by the many thousands. So it's difficult to actually mass your forces for any significant breakthrough, which is why any loss of territory is rather tactical and isn't necessarily very big from the standpoint of even public relations, right? Russians will claim any square kilometer is a big win. They'll compare it to Stalingrad, but in reality, Ukrainians have to reallocate their sources and their resources, and they'll have to decide exactly where to make the stand. Yes, Russia is massing a lot of forces. Russia is preparing hundreds of thousands more troops. But again, the questions remain whether any significant breakthrough would indeed be possible with so many intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance and combat assets present in Ukraine, which is why Ukraine has been using FPV drones, for example, as replacements to and complementary to the lack of artillery shells at this point. Obviously, Ukraine is sounding alarm. It needs specific type of weapons to withstand the upcoming Russian advance. But I think even the Russians understand that this isn't going to be a walk in the park. And whether or not they're prepared to lose tens of thousands of soldiers in assaults similar to those that we've witnessed in 2022 and 2023 remains to be seen. Russian military is much stronger today. It's much more professional. A lot of lessons from the early losses were absorbed and corrected. But again, we don't know whether that applies to the entire force. As we have already discussed, even when it comes to protecting very important assets inside Russia, that process is rather uneven. At the front, there's indications that some of the lessons learned from earlier combat with Ukrainians is also probably going to apply unevenly. So yes, Ukraine has a lot to be concerned about, but it's unclear whether Russia would be able to make very significant breakthroughs against Ukrainian territory, against Ukrainian forces, while all of the other elements are still basically in play, including ISR drones, combat drones, and of course, Ukrainian knowledge and their incredible ability to withstand the Russian assaults.
To better be able, I want to go to mobilizations on both sides. Zelensky just lowered the draft age to augment what has been a depleted and an exhausted army. Right, Ukrainians with less ammunition have been holding the line, but their fatality rates have been very high among their most experienced troop cadre, which is one of the reasons why everybody is making the case that it's urgent that the United States, Europe, and everybody else provide more aid to Ukraine, right? As the Ukrainians are standing up their own defense industries, but still not producing enough in the scale necessary. I want to go to the people equation. The United States warned Moscow that there was going to be an attack on the Crocus Concert Hall. For whatever reason, the Russians ignored that warning, right? I mean, when the attack was happening, there was not a lot of security at the facility, which you would have thought the Russians would have done unless there was another reason not to do it. Turns out they wanted to be able to blame the attack on Ukrainians somehow, even though it was an ISIS-K attack. And the question has been how Moscow is going to respond and whether or not a troop mobilization, for example, that this is the trigger to try to drive that. And the Russians, right, always bold, have accused Ukraine of being the terrorist state and demanding that it's, you know, it hand over its senior intelligence and military leaders, right? Something that's not going to happen. How is Putin likely going to use that concert hall attack that left about 140 dead and, about the same number wounded? How does he use that? And is a mobilization going to be the next thing? And how does that affect the war, as well as how Ukraine's mobilization is going to help the Ukrainians, because they have wanted to spare young people, right? They were drafting older people so that, you know, they don't rob the country of its future. Whereas they're realizing that, you know, this is not working and we're simply running out of people. Walk us through the calculus on both sides.
Well, so it's not clear how how Russian intelligence agencies and security agencies have ignored the warnings passed by the U.S. It's likely that they probably were distrustful of American intelligence assessments. It is likely that they wanted to showcase that despite the war somewhere in Ukraine, things inside Russia, despite recent drone attacks, are actually quite stable. It's not clear why Crocus Hall didn't have a lot of uniformed guards or armed guards for that matter. That's rather surprising as well. So there's a lot of questions about this attack, which is why so many people are pointing out that this was basically some form of internal miscommunication, which was taken advantage of by other internal or external partners. As far as mobilization in Russia, well, right now the government is finally saying the word war. And they are switching from calling it SVO, Specialная военная операция, or special military operation, to a war. And this was first voiced by Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov, as well as by Putin himself and other members of Russian government. So now that Russia is officially at war, mobilization could be on the table. Of course, Russian mobilization will lead to similar consequences as the first draft in 2022. Many people will probably want to leave. Many people will probably want to evade the draft. Many people don't want to be part of a war. The country, Russia, and Russian people were okay with a special military operation, which implies something limited in scope. And as long as the war continued somewhere in Ukraine, it didn't really affect most Russian families. There really was no dissent or any pressure on the Russian government to act otherwise. Again, it's not clear how the society will react to a mobilization, whether or not there will be a lot of immigration or any type of dissent. On the Ukrainian side, of course, this could be rather problematic as Ukraine has a smaller population than Russia. Ukraine has a finite number of soldiers that could be drafted overall, even if that number is large. And Ukraine is sounding essentially alarm at the lack of certain weapons and systems. That's why it wants these weapons from the United States, from NATO, so it doesn't have to raise a big army to withstand the upcoming Russian assaults and Russian advances.
So this is as much about replenishing a tired army as it is a hedging strategy, given the United States has been late in authorizing the latest amount of assistance, even though there is some speculation that one of the reasons the Pentagon is not, that it has more authority but hasn't been using it, in part because it's worried about depleting its own stocks that it might need elsewhere in the world. But is it a hedging strategy, do you think, on the part of the Ukrainians until new weapons arrive?
I think so. And again, I'm not privy to the decisions made in the Ukrainian MOD, and we're kind of speculating here, but Ukraine is concerned. It's been concerned for quite a while. It wants these weapons, so it doesn't have to draft a big army. And because these weapons are late at arriving, it is now trying to hedge its strategies.
Right. Let me ask you about the one-year anniversary of the prominent Russian blogger who was killed in St. Petersburg last year. You know, he made predictions about the war and a lot of debate on who killed him. Ultimately, right? I mean, the Russians have managed to kill or convince people, unfortunately, that's not funny, right, to commit suicide by their own hand, as opposed to being somehow assassinated by the Russian state. And we're going to get to that in a little moment as well. You know, he was making predictions about the course of the war. You know, how are folks commemorating his death? And what did he predict before he died that is or isn't coming true a year later about the course of the war?
Right. We're talking about Maxim Fomin, a.k.a. Vladlen Tatarsky, or VT. He was one of the more prominent Russian military bloggers that really rose to fame in 2022 and very early 2023, because he started talking about the importance of drones. He was talking about the importance of commercial drones, especially FPV type drones. And so he called for the Russian defense sector, as well as for multiple Russian volunteer efforts across the country, to manufacture these in the many tens and hundreds of thousands, because he was talking about FPV drones as one of the main weapons at the tactical level, which Russia still lacked, obviously, in 2022 and early 2023, right before he was assassinated. Since his death, he has become sort of a you know, a dark profit for many Russian volunteer groups, volunteer organizations, military units. There's a drone right now, FPV drone, manufactured by Sudoplatov effort with the help of Project Archangel volunteer effort. It's called VT-40. It's named after him. It's one of the more prominent FPV type drones used at the front right now. There's a lot of commemoration on Russian Telegram channels, a lot of commemoration across other media networks, but he predicted the utmost importance of these type of tactical drones in warfare, and he wanted the government and the military to place an emphasis on using these in tactical engagements and then eventually sort of move up the production away from volunteer ad hoc unconnected efforts more to the military industrial level that only the state can provide. And so a lot of this is sort of coming true right now. A lot of FPV drones or commercial drones are assembled by lots of Russian volunteers. The numbers are quite large, even if the number of drones actually used in combat remains to be much smaller. As far as the Russian state essentially taking over the production of FPV drones, that hasn't happened yet, but a lot of volunteers are calling for it. And obviously the Russian military has long recognized the importance of tactical commercial and FPV drones in this war.
I think it was interesting that in President Biden's call with Xi Jinping, the president raised the issue of Chinese help for Russia's war machine. And you've noted several times, right, that the Chinese are the ones that are supplying both sides with the electronics to make possible these vast unmanned fleets, which I think is fascinating.
This war would be very different if China was not in play and if Chinese components would not go into the production of hundreds of thousands of FPV drones. I mean, how different would this war be if DJI quadcopters or FPV drones were not present, or if they were present in very small numbers? So yes, China has a very outsized importance in this war, and it remains a very, very important military and economic partner to Russia.
Last questions as we wrap up. And the first one is, you know, you've written and spoken about this as well, that by the end of the year, there might be one FPV drone above every soldier and vehicle on the battlefield, right? That fundamentally would change what land warfare looks like. What are people doing to prepare for this?
There's a lot of developments of countermeasures. There's a lot of developments in tactical electronic warfare, in physical protection against FPV and commercial type drones, in radio electronics reconnaissance to identify these drones on approach, in development of training and tactics to use tactical level kinetic systems to shoot down drones, everything down to basically a basic shotgun to try and shoot down such drones in close proximity. A lot of these do not address the threat of FPV drones right now. And again, we can argue whether or not what is happening in Ukraine is a unique moment in time or a pattern of things to come, right? When it comes to positional warfare, when it comes to military stalemates, what is evident, however, is that both sides in Ukraine are warning that there are already enough drones, FPV drones right now, to try and target every single soldier. And in 2023, we haven't seen that quite yet. We saw FPV drones target specific pre-identified targets. Now, both sides are engaged in what is called a free hunt, where an FPV pilot can just fly his or her drone and just target anything that looks like an adversary, including a single soldier. There's lots of videos of soldiers trying to evade an FPV drone, and we're basically seeing the last few seconds of their life as these soldiers are desperately trying to hide or do something against the drone, and the video ends up in a big explosion, of course, and death of a soldier. So that's already happening. A lot of Ukrainians are sounding alarm that if things don't change on the battlefield, if there are not enough countermeasures or other technical solutions, there could be enough FPV drones to make things extremely difficult for all types of soldiers, all type of movements, you know, all types of weapons and systems. Again, these are not replacements for artillery, but they're definitely complementary to and sometimes can be surrogates for the lack of certain types of weapons and systems at the front. With both sides using similar tactics, both sides using similar technologies and similar concepts, we may have reached sort of an FPV type stalemate,
Right.
Where something new is necessary and a breakthrough is absolutely needed because both sides have mirror imaged each other into a full and complete stalemate.
I think what's fascinating is that the Ukrainians sort of were ahead of the power curve in terms of using these systems for precision strike to, you know, counterbalance the Russian advantage in artillery. So Russia was using mass, Ukraine was using precision in order to stabilize that line. And I think one of the most incredible scenes was a Russian soldier surrendering to a Ukrainian drone that went and brought a sign, right? He threw his hands up, the drone went away, brought a sign back saying, drop your weapon and come with me, and then escorted the guy back, which I think was pretty amazing.
Right.
Folks are surrendering to unmanned systems, even though they're technically not a full, as you've noted, like nothing is autonomous here, right? Every one of them has a pilot in them.
Right. And again, this is all possible because both sides are using the same technology. Both sides are using essentially the same Chinese suppliers to assemble their FPV drones. There are some variations, right. Obviously. There are now some indigenous technologies that go into manufacture of some of these drones, technologies which are built in Ukraine or technologies built in Russia. But still, most FPV drones are wholesale, made from the same type of Chinese components. And that's why Russia was able to catch up very quickly, because it basically copied what Ukraine was doing, and it was able to have easy access to simple commercial components which could be available in bulk. Again, we can argue whether this is a very unique moment in time or whether this is a pattern of things to come, but certainly other armies, other combatants around the world are watching what's happening in Ukraine, and they're trying to copy that as well.
Last question, and I know our time is unfortunately very brief. In a joint report, 60 Minutes, The Insider and Der Spiegel reported that Russia is behind the so-called Havana Syndrome attacks that have involved high-powered directed energy weapons, microwave weapons that have been used to debilitate Americans at home and abroad, most of whom are actually involved in countering Russian espionage. These are, you know, some of the nation's most experienced counter-espionage forces. The investigative reporter Christo Grozhev of The Insider has rightly said that this is effectively a declaration of war. And the Russians just conducted an assassination last month of a Russian pilot who defected to Ukraine with classified documents in his Mi-8 helicopter. He was killed. And there are a number of other assassinations that we know of, and a lot more we suspect, that have been going on in the West for a long time. The Skripal matter, and Litvinenko were just, you know, two of them. There may be dozens and dozens more. And we know that the Russians have been using these capabilities to attack Americans all over the world. The U.S. government has sort of put the kibosh on this, in part because it said they don't really know how to respond to it, right? Because the Americans aren't being killed. They're just being maimed for life with concussion-like symptoms. You know, Sam, does this help change the narrative and how people ought to be thinking of Russia as a threat? Because, you know, if they're using it against American diplomats and counterintelligence officials, it's only a matter of time before they turn it on all of their critics, as the Russians have said. Like, anybody who criticizes, you know, Russia is right. Fair game as far as we're concerned.
Well,
you know,
so
and especially if you're formerly Russian.
There's two things to consider. Number one, U.S. intelligence agencies are still not sure what this is, right? And a report last year couldn't really identify a quote-unquote state backer in this technology. There's certainly a lot of coincidences which lend themselves to a narrative, right? But there's still a lot of questions about that. Two, Russia actually was discussing the development of different types of acoustic weapons for quite a while. Even before the invasion of Ukraine, there were some developments and tests, I believe, in Russia's National Guard about weapons to control crowds. And I believe they even ran several tests where they tried some of these weapons against the crowds. And the main emphasis for those weapons development was their non-lethal nature, meaning not something that shoots and maims physically, but something that can affect people or disperse people. But again, even U.S. intelligence agencies are somewhat split over what exactly is the cause of the Havana syndrome and whether or not this is directly linked to Russian agencies.
The United States also has developed similar capabilities, which is why we're familiar with them. And we decided that, you know, that they were particularly worrying, I recall some time ago, about the fielding of that, even though we do have certain acoustic systems in order to protect ships and from pirates and whatnot. One of the challenges is, of course, that the intelligence community wants sort of clearer attribution. They want it to sort of be 100%, where at this point, there's a high degree of certitude that it is likely the Russians. Ultimately, what does the international community need to do to contain an adversary that is actually trying to act as if, you know, in defiance of international law? And their attitude is, I can always grab more innocent hostages to trade for the Victor Boots or the Berlin Shooter or anybody else. And unfortunately, we're too eager to trade these guys to get these innocent people out, right? So, I mean,
Right.
what kind of approach, strategic approach, do we need? Because the Russians are getting more and more emboldened. The less you do to stop them, the more they're going to just keep doing it, is the way they operate.
Well, that's a good question. I don't think there's a consensus on what exactly must be done against Russia in such cases. You just pointed out that the United States is also developing such weapons and systems. Obviously, other major militaries and security agencies around the world are probably working on similar solutions as well. So that's why it's probably not a very simple task to actually point fingers and say that such party is responsible, because the accused party can point fingers back and saying, but you're also developing such weapons and systems, and this isn't us, this is you kind of using it against your own people as a test run. That's why I think this is such a difficult assessment. But it was important for this public exposé to take place so that we can finally start talking about it publicly.
Yeah, indeed. Sam, thanks very much. Always an honor and pleasure having you on the program. Hope you have a great week and look forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Fargo.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, HII, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. We'll be back again tomorrow with the Air Power Podcast, and joining us will be Brian Clark of the Hudson Institute to talk about his new report that he co-authored with his colleague Dan Pat on hedging strategies. Thanks very much again. And until we see you again, have a great day.